The New Atlantean Dictionary of Literary Terms, a complete reference in 4 volumes. Volume 2, H through M. Hyperbole, a Greek word meaning overshooting, bold overstatement, or the extravagant exaggeration of fact or of possibility. On Earth, few scientists or lab technicians ever stuck around long enough to really appreciate Rodney McKay's managerial style. On Atlantis, the physics and engineering teams, along with the various department heads, have all, for the most part, made their peace with it. The new recruits still get caught out by it sometimes. They hear, "Oh my God, we're all going to die in 30 seconds!" and dive under their desks, even though Miko and Coleman know that this really means, if I hadn't caught this problem, something may have had the potential to explode on the West Pier next Thursday. They'll hear, "If you don't properly align that circuitry pattern, you will fry your own brain and leave yourself a vegetable." And they take it seriously, hands shaking as they concentrate on their task. The Exposito and Watson know that this really means, do it right, or you could receive a mild shock. The new guys don't know that. "It is not humanly possible for this to be fixed," is almost always followed by Rodney fixing whatever it is before lunch. The thing is, McKay can sell it, eyes wide with fear, hands gripping the control console, throwing things, dropping things, cursing, yelling. He's really very method, mostly because he believes it himself. So even the old hands, the people who've been around since the beginning, can sometimes get caught up in it, finding themselves running through corridors at full tilt to fix an inconsequential cross wire, or working frantically without sleep to finish routine water systems analysis. So when the crises do happen, McKay's barked orders and dire imprecations have a bizarre twofold effect. Everyone assumes that it's not as bad as he says it is, even when it is, and so they work calmly and avoid panic. But they're so used to acting as if it really is as bad as he says it is, even when it's not, that they sprint down corridors and work into the night at times when sprinting and sleeplessness are actually necessary to keep the city from blowing up. Ambrose suspects himself to be the victim of behavioral conditioning of the kind outlawed by all kinds of international law, but he isn't too broken up about it. He hasn't done this much good work since grad school, which was, of course, the other time that he was in constant fear for his life. Miko gets so used to pronouncements of doom that whenever Rodney is off-world for a few days, she finds herself taking up the slack, dropping things and throwing things and yelling and going wide-eyed with fear a bit herself. Esposito and Coleman seem to appreciate it, picking up their tablet computers and making a dash for those cross wires like they're off to save nunneries full of orphans and kittens. When Rodney gets back from 2 days of harvesting purple flowers, or, as the science division will hear it, trade negotiations, he watches with delight as his minions scurry about the lab. He really is the best manager ever. In medias res. This phrase, the Latin for into the middle of things, has become almost a cliché to describe a common method of beginning a story. In other words, starting in the middle of the action at some crucial point, when a good deal has already happened. Taylor slides her hands under Kate's ass and pulls it forward, angling her hips upward, getting her own naked body between Kate's spread thighs. Kate's muscles are pleasingly strong against Taylor's hard shoulders. Then Taylor gets her mouth on Kate's sex, wasting no time, pushing her tongue inside, hot and slick. It's been so long since Taylor's done this, tasted a woman, given in to this urge. Athosian women bear children to raise against the wraith. They don't turn to each other except for occasional pleasure or comfort. Taylor has always rationed it out. Kate makes noises as Taylor tongues her, sucks her, gets fingers up inside and begins to stroke against the fluttering clench of her body. Little gasps. Little moments of breath lost, but they stoke the fire low in Taylor's belly. They're not weighed or considered, not thoughtful or kind. Kate groans low and greedy, and her breath stutters, and Taylor can't help but want more, want to wring those throaty sounds out from between her bitten lips. Kate showed up at Talus' door with a bottle of wine and a gleam in her eye. Talus participated in enough seductions that she understood Kate's meaning immediately, though she did not understand what had changed to lead Kate to this decision. Why now? Why this night? Perhaps Kate has been rationing herself, too. They sipped the wine and talked their usual talk, while Kate towed off her shoes and touched Taylor's shoulder casually, and then Taylor leaned over and kissed her throat slowly, with precision. Custom dictates that days should pass between the declaration and the act, that formal words be said by both parties, that everyone should make their intentions clear. Taylor had set her lips into the dip between Kate's collarbones and forgotten each custom in turn as she tasted the sweet salt of her freckled skin. As Kate comes under Taylor's mouth, around her fingers, Taylor gives up thoughts of rationing, gives up on taking things slowly, on doing this in stages. She will take it all now, here, every noise and shudder and drop of sweat that Kate has to give. The roughened heel of Kate's foot scrapes against the smooth skin of Taylor's back as her whole body shudders and releases, her muscles trembling. Taylor squeezes her eyes shut, living in the taste and smell and feel of her, hot and slippery beneath her mouth. Eventually, Taylor eases off, gentling her hand as Kate comes back down, allowing herself one last chaste kiss to the soft flesh of her sex, before sliding up Kate's body and kissing her. Juxtaposition, a placing or being placed in nearness or contiguity or side by side, often done in order to compare and contrast the two, to show similarities or differences. In literature, a contrast in register or style, in logic, an observational fallacy in which two items placed next to each other seem to have a correlation when none is actually claimed. "What do you want me to do?" Kate asks, her thumb on Taylor's nipple, her thigh pressing hard between Taylor's legs. "Just touch me," Taylor answers, squirming under her hands. "Like this? Yes. Oh." Kate runs her other hand down Taylor's bicep, over her soft belly and down to find her clit, pushing her body against Taylor's, lips, hands, thighs, tongue. Sliding skin on skin, their eyes locked as Taylor's orgasm rushes through her, as Taylor arches and gasps against her. Kate slows her fingers and is about to pull her hand back up when Taylor's fingers close on her wrist. "Just, if you will, just a little more." Taylor guides Kate's fingers back over her clit, their hands working in tandem against Taylor's bare flesh. Kate watches as Taylor closes her eyes against her second orgasm. Kate finds herself collapsed on top of her, their limbs akimbo, her breasts against Taylor's belly. Taylor is gorgeous beneath her, hair damp against her temples, nipples tight and flushed dark. Kate pushes herself off the bed and finds her underwear. "You are leaving?" Taylor's tone is light and easy, not accusatory at all. Kate is grateful for the relaxed attitude that the Athosians take to lesbian sex. It's been too long since she's had this kind of release. Looking over her shoulder as she hooks her bra, Kate notices the inviting expanse of rumpled sheets next to Taylor on the bed, the space where she could curl her body against Taylor's warmth. "I have an early morning client, I'm afraid," Kate says. "Will we do this again?" Kate imagines doing this every night, imagines frantic fucking and long evenings of slow exploration, imagines her hands spanning Taylor's body in time, coming to know every inch of her skin. Kate imagines the feel of Taylor's fingers in her ass, the way she could rub herself off against Taylor's thighs, imagines those white teeth scraping her nipples. "Maybe," Kate answers, smiling openly as she buttons her fly. "I had such a good time tonight, but I also really value you as a friend, and I don't want that to change. Sometimes it's best for everyone to keep these things at a casual level." Taylor nods slowly. "Perhaps," she says. Kate picks up the empty wine bottle from earlier in the evening. "You want me to take this to recycling for you?" "That would be fine. Thank you." Kate pauses before the bed. Taylor is still naked amidst the folds of the sheets, skin glowing dark and golden in the soft lamplight. She could be posing for a Greek statue, one knee drawn up slightly, resting back on her elbows, hair falling over her bare shoulders. Kate could go back, at least, could kiss her soft mouth again before she leaves, could let the gesture say, "You're so beautiful. I love doing this with you. I can't wait to see you again tomorrow." She smiles gently and doesn't kiss Taylor. "You are so beautiful. I loved this." She pauses. "See you for lunch tomorrow?" Taylor smiles back at her and nods her assent. Kate leaves. Kunstroman, a German term for a novel which has an artist in any creative art as the central character and which shows the development of the artist from childhood to maturity and later. Even as a kid, Evan knew that it wasn't the kind of thing you talked about. The art classes that his mom taught at the community college were full of eager young men and women with experimental hair who took it seriously. But the art classes in his school were full of stoners who couldn't be trusted in the automotive shop. If anyone had learned that Evan liked painting, it would have been the end of his cool and the beginning of his getting beaten up. His mom always assured him that the other kids would be impressed if they could just see how good he was. But that was its own set of problems. His paintings weren't exactly the kind you can show the guys on the football team. Since his mom taught on Saturday afternoons, when Evan didn't have school, he would go into the college with her and paint at her teaching studios with her students. The problem was, the only thing she ever seemed to teach was figure drawing. As a result, by the time Evan was 15, he had dozens of portraits of naked men in his closet dating back years, charcoal and oil and mixed media on the top, with watercolors just below them, and if he digs far enough, canvases covered in non-toxic finger paint. There's one of a particularly well-endowed middle-aged man done in crayon that his mother was always especially proud of. Evan was in high school before he convinced her to take it off the fridge. His first year in college, he talks a girl he's in love with into letting him paint her. Her nervous giggles and messy hair, a stark contrast to the professional models he'd painted in his mother's studio. She's not the first naked woman he's ever painted, but she's the first person he's ever seen like this, beautiful and familiar under his soft brushstrokes. They date for almost a year before they break up in one of those famous screaming matches that everyone in the dorm gets to listen in on. At the time, Evan wanted to destroy his paintings of her, but they remain pristine, stacked neatly at the back of his closet. He paints a lot after that, a few nudes, but mostly clothed models, women he dates, best friends, and when he's home for Christmas, one of his mother. He only tells the people he trusts, and he only paints the people he tells. Every now and then, he tries a landscape or a still life, but it comes out all wrong every time. He can't paint without the meanings that bodies hold in their angles, in their lines of muscles, and in their yielding curves. He joins the Air Force on the same day he graduates from college, and he never looks back. There are no easels or brushes in OTC, nor are there flurries of art appreciation societies. Sometimes he wants to tell his fellow cadets, "I wish I could paint you." But there's no way to explain it. Still, these men, and Cadet O'Reilly, their female recruit, are closer to him than anyone else in his life. And so sometimes, at night, he lies in his bed in the barracks and sketches secretly, charcoal between his fingers, capturing the faces of the sleeping cadets around him. His first week in Atlantis, he walks into Colonel Shepard's office to find him sitting on his desk, on a stack of forms to be submitted to the SGC, actually, practicing intently with a yo-yo. He coughs. "Oh, hey, Major. What's up?" Shepard doesn't stop yo-yoing. "Sir, far be it from me to say, But aren't you worried about sending the wrong, professional impression? He glances at the yo-yo, which is bright red and lights up when it's in motion, in what he hopes is a meaningful manner. All right, all that stuff. You know, Major, we do things a little differently on Atlantis. I know you're new, but really... The colonel grins blindingly when he takes the yo-yo around the world. Lauren's fingers itch for charcoal. It's better if you relax. Get a feel for the people around here. We've got enough to worry about with the Wraith on our doorstep every Friday night. I say, if you have a yo-yo, go ahead and yo-yo to your heart's content. Lauren smiles a little nervously. Of course, sir. He doesn't understand it at the time, but over the next years he sees a lot of metaphorical yo-yos on Atlantis and gets to liking it. It's as if all the world's yo-yoers converged on this one spot. Then one day, there's some sort of sentient vegetable attack, and Lauren finds himself suddenly hooked into the brains of his jumper squadron, and also the brains of everyone else in Atlantis. Afterwards, he can't shake the feeling, the sense that he already knows everything about these people, that they already know him, that maybe they knew about him all along. The next day, he's got a pencil in his hand and a sheet of 8x10 computer paper beneath his palm. He'll order canvases and paints on the Daedalus. But he has to do this now. He wonders who he should ask, or who he could draw without them noticing. Some of the scientists sit still a lot. But it's not really what he wants to capture, or it's not that he wants to capture just one person. So he walks out as far as he can on the East Pier and sits cross-legged on the dock, salt air in his lungs. Beneath the pencil, the spires of the city fall onto the paper as though they were always meant to be there. Leitmotif, used as a literary term to denote a recurrent theme or unit, it is occasionally used in a broader sense to refer to an author's favorite themes. "Is it just me, or does this happen a lot?" Rodney shouts, ducking behind a tree. John lays down some cover fire so that Ronan and Tayla can converge on their position. "What, you mean mortal danger, the team in jeopardy, that kind of thing?" Ronan and Tayla come running up to crouch beside Rodney. "No, no, well, yes, that part, but everything else. We arrive, we get along, then there's some ridiculous miscommunication." Rodney pauses as the other three fire through the tree cover at the locals who are trying to kill them with Genii-style guns, and we end up in mortal peril. Ronan sights carefully, stunning one of the people taking cover behind another copse of trees. "That's not all the time," he says, looking through his sights for another target. "Sometimes there's a miscommunication, and then we have to do ritual penance." "Enemy approaching at 9 o'clock, Taylor warns, turning and firing at the group trying to flank them. "But still, miscommunication followed by disaster," Rodney insists as he joins Taylor in covering their 9. "We go on 3, John says, his fingers quickly pointing out the route they're about to take. "Down that path to the valley. I'm on our 6, Taylor takes point. The gate's what, half a click from the base of the hill?" "A little less," Rodney answers. John counts to 3, and they break cover and start down the hill, tumbling and crashing into one another, but managing not to fall. "So assuming you're right," John says, as they start the sprint to the gate, "what exactly do you suggest?" "I do not believe that is Rodney's point," Taylor grunts a moment later, running ahead of Rodney. "Down!" Ronan screams suddenly, and they all drop as bullets begin whizzing by. They manage to low crawl to a nearby rock formation that provides some cover. John and Ronan start scanning the tree line for the sniper. "Thank you, Taylor, yes," Rodney puffs, automatically turning to cover their 12. "The point is, why can't anyone in this backwards galaxy just say what they mean?" "Oh, this is a complaint," John realizes. "Sorry, I thought we were doing a team-building rant." Then John stills Ronan with a hand to his shoulder and points carefully at a glint of light in the bushes. Ronan fires his stunner, a sudden grunt from the tree line testifying to his accuracy. "Well, I guess the galaxy's more interesting this way." John says, as they get back into crouches, ready to start the last 100 yards to the gate. Ronan runs backward, taking over John's position as John goes up to point.
"Besides," Ronan adds, "you're all just as bad. I don't remember the last time either of you said what you meant."
"Yeah," Rodney's out of breath now, but keeping up. "But we never say, 'Come have a feast and some dancing,' when we really mean, 'If you say yes, you agree to marry all our sons and daughters and grow beans.'"
Taylor starts dialing the DHT.
"It is a question of context, I suppose," she says. And then,
"Atlantis, this is Taylor. We are coming in hot."
Chuck's voice crackles in their headsets.
"Noted."
"So, miscommunication and disaster, huh?" John asks as they step into Atlantis, right on schedule.
Rodney shrugs. "I'm just saying."
Metonymy, a figure of speech in which the name of an attribute of a thing is substituted for the thing itself. Metonymy works by the coincidence of and contiguity, association, between two concepts, whereas metaphor works by the similarity between them. Metonymy, unlike metaphor, does not bring two things together in order to transfer qualities from one to another, but rather because they tend to be found together. For instance, there is nothing crown-like about a monarch, but the crown is a common metonym for a king or queen. 2 weeks later, in an Intruvian jail cell whose floor seemed to be comprised at least partially of animal dung, Rodney holds out for almost 10 minutes before breaking out the "I told you so."
"I told you so. Fine, McKay. You were right. Now let's figure out a way out of here."
Shepard is already poking at the bases of the metal bars, trying to find a loose one.
"Okay, but I just want it noted for the record."
Rodney starts on the bars on the other side of the door.
"In the event of your grisly death, I will be sure to tell the world about your prescience,"
Shepard assures him.
"Maybe it's you," Rodney says, harsher than he intends. "Maybe it's because you piss people off, and I just happen to be standing next to you at the time."
"Yeah, I'm the one who pisses people off," John mutters, and reaches for the next bar.
Rodney blanches.
"You're the one who got us thrown in here," he snaps back, gritting his teeth.
There'd been a moment when, he remembers with fondness the golden time they spent working with Mirla's people, Shepard's thigh next to his as they sat together at the banquet, when they just happened to be sitting next to each other, coincidentally.
"Well, maybe instead of complaining about it, you could do your actual job and find us a way to escape," John says, hands pulling at the bars as if to force them out of the concrete by pure will.
After a long time in the cold cell, hours maybe, they took Rodney's watch, they're sitting on the hard, manure-packed ground in silent defeat. The bars aren't moving, there are no windows, and they have nothing but their hands to dig with.
"Well, maybe Ronan and Taylor got away and will rescue us," Rodney attempts in an upbeat tone, which never works for him.
Just then, a wiry little man with an eye patch over one eye shows up at the cell door, flanked by half a dozen armed men.
"Which of you is Atlantis?"
he demands, holding up a wicked-looking sword. Rodney doesn't like the sound of this.
"Who's asking?"
Shepard says casually, leaning against the wall like he's at a party.
"The throne of Atruvius is asking,"
the man snarls. Shepard squares off against the guy.
"I represent Atlantis, where, by the way, our leader is probably very angry at you for kidnapping us."
Shepard stops talking as the man with the sword unlocks the door, pulls Shepard out, and gets the sword against his neck, while slamming the gate shut again. Rodney grips the bars anxiously.
"You'll do,"
the man says as he hauls Shepard off. Hours later, Shepard is returned, covered in dirt and sweat, with a gash on one arm that oozes blood.
"Jesus, Shepard, what happened?"
Rodney demands as he helps him to sit.
"Pretty much that movie with Russell Crowe and the slavery and the Colosseum," John answers, wincing. "A gladiator ring? Are you serious?"
Shepard spares some energy to glare at him.
I didn't get into this state playing Monopoly, Rodney.
We need to get out of here, Rodney grits out. But it's stone and metal, too low tech for him to work any miracles. The next day, the same guy with the eye patch shows up at their cell with the same toughs backing him up.
Which of you is Atlantis? He demands.
John is on his feet, wincing as yesterday's bruises and pulled muscles make themselves known.
I am, he says quickly, and is dragged away.
Rodney waits to see if he comes back. On the fourth day, when Shepard is tossed back into the cell, there's a nasty puncture wound in his thigh. On the fifth day, Rodney is ready.
Which one of you is Atlantis? Eyepatch asks.
John, feverish and still bleeding, struggles to get up.
I am, he grinds out.
No, Rodney says, approaching the bars.
I am.
The man on the other side of the bars grins at him, his teeth perfect and white.
You don't look like much of a fighter, he says,
pulling Rodney out of the cell and ignoring Shepard's protests in the background.
You're not like his, your friend.
No, Rodney mutters, half to himself, as he's pushed down the musty corridors and given a sword.
I'm just the guy who stands next to him.